getting chills. That was Japanese soprano Eri Nakamura singing the role of Cho-Cho-San in the Royal Opera House's revival of Puccini's Madama Butterfly. Hi, I'm Femi Ok. Today on the stream, Yellowface in 2022? Opera has some serious catching up to do when it comes to Orientalism and anti-Asian racism. Some opera companies are rethinking how to stage problematic works in a culturally appropriate way. That is our show today. You can join us in the comments section of YouTube. Daniel, Nina, Phil, so good to have all three of you with us. We are talking about problematic opera productions, and you are the people to bring it. Daniel, hello. Please say hello to our audience around the world. Tell them who you are, what you do.
My name's Daniel Yorklow. I'm a writer, actor, filmmaker, musician. I'm associate artist director of Chinese Arts Now, which is a combined arts company in London, and a founder member and continuing member of BEATS, British East Southeast Asians in Theatre and on Screen, good, which is an advocacy group.
Good to have you, Dan. Hello, Nina. Welcome to the stream. Please introduce yourself to our viewers around the world.
Hi, I'm Nina Yoshida Nelson. I'm a mezzo-soprano. I've sung Suzuki and Madame Butterfly over 150 times, and I am a co-founder of the Asian Opera Alliance. We advocate for Asians in the opera industry, and I'm also an artistic advisor at Boston Lyric Opera.
So much expertise. I'm excited. Hello, Phil. Welcome to the stream. Please introduce yourself to our audience around the world.
Hi, everybody. My name is Phil Chan. I'm an author, a choreographer and a writer, and the co-founder of Final Bow for Yellowface and the president of the Gold Standard Arts Foundation. A lot of my work started out around a conversation started about 6 years ago with the artistic director of New York City Ballet about how to represent Asian characters on stage better, which has snowballed into a much larger global conversation that pretty much every major American ballet is now part of this conversation to improve how we represent Asians on stages. So thank you so much for having me.
Ah, so good to have you. So Daniel, Nina, Phil, one question for one is a question for all. I know you will come to it from different perspectives. Let's start on my laptop. This is why we're doing the show. I caught a headline that surprised me, made me stop. Have a look here on my laptop. Royal Opera stages Madama Butterfly with changes to respect Japanese culture. That drew me in. That was fascinating. Let's start, though, Nina, with Madama Butterfly. How many times have you performed it? Are you still counting?
Yeah, definitely over 150 times.
Right.
It's my signature role.
All right, very good. You are a great person to tell us the story. What's the story?
Absolutely. So it's a story, it's a love story and a tragedy. I won't tell you the ending. I'll let you see it and you can know it yourself once you see the opera. But
sure. It
is a story about a young girl who falls in love, a Japanese girl who falls in love with a naval officer who comes to Japan. And it's their love story about how she sits and she waits for him after he goes back out to sea and waits and hopes that one day he'll come back.
Madame Butterfly is problematic now because of the way certain characters are portrayed. Phil, can you hit on a couple of the areas that makes it quite difficult to see this production in 2022?
Sure. So I think a lot of the opera repertory, we have to remember, comes from Europe, and Europe has not always had the most enlightened views of people outside of its boundaries. So exotic people, Orientalism, it's in many cases this fantasy Asia that European creators were using to tell stories outside of their own social norms. And so that was the way it worked back then. It was really innovative. It was a way to create new stories and explore new themes, taboo themes, things like race that were not easy to explore in a native setting. However, these works, as they continue to be beloved by generation after generation, we also have to recognize that times change, our societies are a lot more mixed, and we're not just programming for Europeans anymore, we're programming for a multiracial audience. And so in order for these art forms like opera to survive that come from Europe, we're sort of at this crossroads where we're like, okay, so what do we do with this repertory that is beautiful, has artistic merit, but also has sensitive issues or problematic, outdated, caricatured versions of different races. So that's what we're grappling, especially as Asian Americans who are in the art form, who love it so much, and who are really coming to it from a place where we don't want to see this work canceled. This is part of our legacy and our history as well. But the question is, how do we do it better so that we're being more inclusive and not just seeing the whole world through a white man's lens from 200 years ago, which doesn't necessarily ring true with who we are today and who our friends and neighbors are and family members. So that's what we're asking with this question is, how do we keep these work alive? Which is, you know, if you think about it, the opposite of cancel culture, right?
And I think it's important to also know that when Puccini wrote this, he had never been to Japan. He knew nothing about the Japanese culture. And the way he studied the Japanese culture was by going to some kabuki shows in Milan. And then he also talked to the Japanese ambassador's wife in Japan and asked about some folk songs. And so that is how he...
Deep research, Nina. That was deep research.
World. Right, yeah. Magical world of butterfly.
Yeah. A fantasy piece of work. Dan, go ahead. You were going to say something.
No, I was going to say, it definitely, you know, what Phil was saying is absolutely true. And I think a lot of European drama is kind of built on that. I mean, the first great hit of the Elizabethan stage was Tamburlaine by Christopher Marlowe, which was set in Central Asia. And it, you know, for audiences of those days, it was incredibly exciting. I kind of think of it like James Bond films when I was a kid. You'd see all these places you were never going to go to if you were a working class kid in Britain. You would never, you know. And I mean, middle class audiences in those days couldn't really, you know, going to Japan, it was like going to the moon, frankly. Yeah. And so we do have this kind of very dated and as Nina was hinting, sort of cursorily researched, you know, maybe researched to the best of his abilities and resources at the time, but that was literally, you know, it's a very, very superficial and kind of exoticized view of a different culture.
What is that experience like, Dan, coming from a heritage that goes back to East Asia, but seeing your culture, your heritage as a stereotype? What does that feel like? What is that like?
Well, I think the problem with it is, especially, I think this is, you know, probably true in America as well, but in Britain, where you know, if you're second, third, fourth, fifth generation, a lot of the time you grow up and you're outside of that culture as well. So what you see is a kind of really weird portrayal of something you don't really know yourself, and you get this kind of awful thing where you feel like. I know as an actor, sometimes in Britain, you sometimes feel that you're being asked to imitate an imitation that white people do of Asian people, which is really strange.
Absolutely. I always say that
Nani, you go first, sorry, and then Phil, you go second.
I always say that I never really identified as Asian until people started identifying me as Asian and putting me into these roles. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, okay, what does it mean to be Japanese? And I had to start figuring out what being Japanese actually meant, because it was so far away from how I grew up.
Yes, Phil.
I think this is also something that many other racial groups feel who are non-white and who are in a space where they're in the minority. I think that a lot of these questions about race also, it's a uniquely Asian situation, because European opera really loved Orientalism as a genre. And so, you know, Black singers, Latino singers, other folks who are from non-Asian groups were not necessarily represented on the European stages and even the top 10 operas that are continually performed. But regularly, there are many Asian characters that continue to be performed every season, Turandot. And what we have to think about, too, is not just the impact on being projected. I think Nina just touched on that very well, is that when we have these ideas in the broader culture about what certain people are supposed to be, so that, you know, Asian women are hyper-submissive but hypersexual, or they're either the geisha or the Turandot, right? You know, this sort of dragon lady. It fits, sort of pigeonholes people into these ideas. And so we, you know, we tend to project these things onto Asian people, whether that's, you know, kind of a weird fetishizing sexuality, or just certain racial ideas are just coded. And you see this across theater, opera, dance, you know, it's all, you know, and then James Bond movies, it's all connected as a part of this broader culture. And so what a lot of Asian Americans like ourselves are trying to tease those things apart, connect the dots, and say, okay, but within this framework, how do we keep this beautiful work alive? And so what I'm looking at is the Royal Opera House production is still set in this very traditionally Orientalist place, which I think is what people are sort of uncomfortable about. And I guess my solution that because a lot of this work, I think we have to focus on solutions. If we look at Shakespeare, which is now, 400 plus years old, I think the reason why his genius survives is because we have the freedom to adapt it and play with it. I mean, how many people can think of a Shakespearean play that is not set exactly the way Shakespeare wrote it to be?
Yeah.
And every time it's set somewhere different, it gives you a nuance or a new flavor, or it gives us a different way of a mirror to our current moment. And that's what makes it powerful. And for some reason, we're very comfortable staging the Magic Flute in different settings, or La Boheme, these other operas that are beloved. But the Orientalist repertory, Turandot, Madama Butterfly, we're stuck in the bus. And what I think we should do is try to find ways to keep that music, but like Shakespeare, like these other productions, just tweak it a little bit, so it doesn't have to be just kimonos and geishas who are 15-year-old girls. I mean, that's so weird.
It's a
15-year-old girl.
All right, I hear you. Let me just bring in another voice here. This is Jane Manari. She's a mezzo-soprano, and she told us this a little bit earlier. Have a listen to Jane. She's talking about the effort that the Royal Opera House went to be culturally appropriate in this current production of Madama Butterfly. They spent a year consulting lots of people. This is Jane's reaction to that.
I think this kind of cultural research is great and is definitely a step in the right direction. But unfortunately, the Opera House are still using yellowface in this show. They're still using someone else's ethnicity as a costume. And that rings pretty tone deaf for me, considering that I look like what I look like and I can't take it off when I leave the theater. And the reality for people who look like me is that hate crimes against us have risen by over 300% since the start of the pandemic. When I look at a production like this, what it feels like to me is that I've walked into a Halloween party where everyone has gotten dressed up in a bad racist costume, and there's absolutely no excuses for doing a production that looks like this in 2022.
Nina, what is it like being on stage with somebody who is made up to look like they're from East Asia, but they're not?
Well, it's really interesting because I think traditions have changed a lot even in the last few years. I think back to when I was first doing my first Madame Butterflies and how the makeup artists used to actually make me try and look more Asian. And now I think the trend has started to be using people's own skin color,
hair color,
things like that.
How do they make you look more Asian when you're Asian?
Well, I think I remember someone saying they tried to flatten out my face here somehow with highlighters or, I don't know. It's been many years, but there are ways to do it, and make your eyes look more Asian. And so I think traditions are changing. And I think one of the most interesting things and also one of the most frustrating things is the fact that there is no actual definition of what is offensive as yellowface. Mm. For me, what I find offensive might be completely different from what the next person down the road finds offensive. For me, it might just be makeup or maybe putting a geisha wig on. But for someone
Dan
else,
is making a face. Dan is making a face. All right, let's go to Dan's face and we go live to Dan's face. Dan, make that face one more time. Dan's face coming to us live. Okay, Dan, why were you making that face?
Some of those photographs are just shocking. I have to say, Nina's right. There's gradations of what people consider yellow face. I mean, I think if you're pretending to be an Asian, whether you're in the makeup or not, you're kind of doing a form of yellow face, I think. But there is obviously the more overt things, which is the makeup, which is the wigs. It's interesting what Nina was talking about, being a mixed race Asian as well. I had that experience on a film set years ago. They wanted me to look more Asian. And it was a beautiful moment when the makeup artist came into the room and sort of took, when she was a black woman, and she sort of looked at one look at me and she said, "I'm not doing that. That's insulting. He's clearly Asian," which was
That must have been a nice. Did you tear up when she said that to you? That's so nice.
I did.
Oh. All right. This is on YouTube. This is a good question, Phil. If I
I do.
Yeah,
have,
go. Go ahead, Phil.
Oh, I did want to clarify the difference between yellow face and Orientalism, because I think that's where folks can get kind of confused. Yellow face is a specific, you know, like is a when you're trying to play a race that you're not, it's often in a caricatured sort of way. Orientalism, which is this larger structure, is setting stories that are set in places like China, India, the Middle East, where all the characters have to be from that race, or that's part of the allure. Mm. And so I think that a work like Madame a Butterfly, you know, there's several different ways to talk about the specific casting, but I think let's just be clear that Yellowface is more of a caricatured, pretending to be a specific Asian person, and then projecting onto that. Orientalism is a larger, like a story.
Yeah, you know? Okay. All right, we understand that. All right, so a couple of thoughts coming from our YouTube community watching right now. Matthew says, I don't think it is important to respectfully portray people. What I want to see is an accurate portrayal of history, whether it is good or bad. Instant response, Dan, Phil, and then Nina. Just a very quick one to Matthew. Dan.
An accurate portrayal of history. I do think when people talk about historical accuracy, we do get into a kind of raft there where, I mean, people will sometimes go and see Shakespeare and they'll see people of colour in it and they'll say that's not historically accurate. But if you were going to be historically accurate with Shakespeare, everyone would have terrible teeth, venereal diseases, be about 4'11" tall. There's no way.
I'd quite like to see that.
I would just say that there's videos. I mean, that's the privilege we have now, is that you can go back and you can watch Maria Callas do Butterfly. You can watch any star of the past do Butterfly in the production you want. So I think that is part of the history. The difference here is we're in the performing arts. We're not in the visual arts or static arts, right? So painting, film, sculpture, photography, those are art forms that capture the zeitgeist of a moment. In the performing arts, we have to make art that reflects the now, always, whether it's theater, opera, dance, whatever. And so part of the fun and the challenge and the messiness of it is having to change. So if you want just tradition, just the historical time capsule approach, video, I'm sorry, because otherwise it doesn't exist. We couldn't even recreate last night's show exactly the way it was last night. So, you know, go look at a painting.
We have to remember also that this is not a historical story. This is just a love story. It could be set in any time. It doesn't have to be set in the early 1900s, right? So there's no reason that we have to keep this story in the past.
All right, so...
I was reading today that Puccini himself revised this 5 times. He did 5 different versions. So maybe if he was around now, maybe he would rock it up a lot more.
Yeah.
Who knows?
All right, so this I'm going to put this one straight to you. This is from LaBelle Kitty watching on YouTube. Thank you, LaBelle Kitty, for doing this. Why don't you just hire Asian opera singers?
Well...
Why spend a year researching cultural sensitivity?
Nina's got this one.
A lot of times that is what happens, and a lot of times we are hired for these roles. The unfortunate thing is then these become the only roles that we are ever hired for. So this becomes a sense of pigeonholing. You know, everyone just sees me as a Japanese-American mezzo-soprano, so of course Nina's going to sing Suzuki in Butterfly. But if there's a whole bigger picture, like our stages in every opera we do need to look like the societies we live in, right? And the second we start just hiring Asian singers to sing in Butterfly, we get in a lot of trouble. Also, if you look, we go back to the history between Japan and China and, you know, and Korea, is it any better if you're hiring a Chinese soprano to sing the lead role as a Japanese artist? I don't know. And so, again, it just comes to, like, even Asian people can be creating caricatures of Asians on stage. So I don't know if it's any better or different to hire Asians.
Are you stuck in Madame Butterfly, Nina? If you're going to be truly honest, are you going to play this for the rest of your singing life?
Hopefully not. And that's one of the reasons I started the Asian Opera Alliance. A friend of mine asked me, you know, Nina, in a traditional season, how many non-Asian roles do you sing? And I went back and I started counting. And of course, you know, 150 plus Suzuki is And in 10 years, I had sung three non-Asian roles. And so I was like, okay, it's time to start advocating. You know, I wasn't even aware of the fact that this is what was happening in
you
my
never
career.
You never have to learn the book, do you, Nina? You never, never have to learn the book. On the plus side, I never have to learn the book. I know it backwards. All right,
exactly.
Let me just bring
I know everybody's lines.
Yeah. Sahoka Sato Timpone spoke to us a little bit earlier. We were talking about, well, how do you fix this issue? What are the problems here with Orientalism in opera? This is what she told us.
I appreciate the initiatives that some opera companies are taking to bring in authenticity to Madama Butterfly, but there is still a misunderstanding of what authentic Japanese really means. I am a licensed kimono dresser and have years of experience in Japanese tea ceremony and traditional dance, yet I once was criticized for not being authentic enough as Suzuki. So I've been wondering what this critic's expectations were. So I do hope that more companies will continue to close this gap. Another possible solution, of course, is to have more Asian artists or artists of Japanese descent in these roles in Butterfly to help bring more authenticity.
So if we go back to the current production of Madama Butterfly at the Royal Opera House, who we did invite to be part of the program, but they were not able to join us, there are two cast members of East Asian heritage in an entire company of a production that is set in Japan. Two. I want to show you this. This is from Oliver Mears. He's the Royal Opera's director, Royal Opera House's director of opera. This is what he told the Guardian newspaper. Casting is more complicated, not least because opera has a more limited talent pool than, for example, that available to film or theatre. But performing Madama Butterfly with an all-Japanese or all-Asian cast and chorus, even a majority cast and chorus, is a wholly unrealistic aim. And would it even be desirable, Dan?
Yeah, I'm really struggling with that. I can't understand the point he's making. I mean, yes, I understand. I did learn about this before when I wrote an article when they did Othello at the Royal Opera House with a white actor playing Othello, a white singer. And I understand there is a certain level of technical achievement you have to have, you know, to be in Madama Butterfly. You can see that, but I mean. That clip you showed at the beginning of the program of the Japanese singer, it was spine chilling.
Wasn't it gorgeous? Hair on the back of my neck has like stood up.
Incredible.
And, oh my goodness.
And I know Nina's done it 150 times and probably is maybe a little bit sick of it, but if Nina was at the Royal Opera House, I might go and see it.
Oh my goodness, we all would go see it. Talking about Nina's performance, we're going to end on Nina singing The Flowering Duet, The Flower Duet, from Lakmé. Can you tell us in two sentences what is happening on the clip that we're going to end on? Because we want to hear your beautiful voice as well as see you talking on the stream. Let's just set it up a little bit and we'll play out with it.
It's a joyous occasion of two friends talking about being in love. It's another Orientalist show and also sometimes very problematic, but it's one of the most beloved duets in opera canon.
All right.
And I do want to give a shout out too. This is from Boston Lyric Opera's Butterfly Process film that Nina was in called Bee. Stunning film. If you want to check out the whole video,
Phil, ever the promoter. Nina, thank you so much. Daniel, what a pleasure. We are going to end on the beautiful voice of Nina singing the Flower Duet from the production Lakmé. Thanks for watching, everyone. See you next time. I think you're going to recognize this music. Have a listen. Enjoy.